From historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, this is The Seminary Explores. Conversations about people, politics, theology, and life with your host, Dr. Gerald Christensen.
It's a pleasure to have with us today Ambassador Lawrence Taylor to talk about Ukraine and the current crisis, or apparent crisis, with our counterparts in Russia, the former Soviet Union. Mr. Taylor is was the ambassador to Estonia at the end of a distinguished career in the Foreign Service, and in his retirement, he and Dr. Bill Rosenbach founded the Gettysburg Leadership Experience, from which he is also now retired. But in both of those capacities, both of the Foreign Service and with the Gettysburg Leadership Experience, he continues to give advice and counsel and a good bit of active participation. Larry, did the Ukraine crisis catch us by surprise?
Well, Jerry, I think it caught everybody by surprise, not just us, but maybe even Russia. You'll recall that that a pro-Russian government in Ukraine was unexpectedly overthrown. And that presented an unexpected challenge to both Russia and to Western Europe and NATO. So everybody was caught by surprise by the change of government. What caught NATO by surprise, which I think is the gist of your question, was the Russian reaction. And the Russian reaction was to intervene in Ukraine itself, to absorb Crimea, which had been part of Ukraine, back into Russia, and then to destabilize and send supplies and arms and eventually even Russian soldiers into eastern Ukraine in an effort to destabilize that portion of Ukraine as well. And it is that reaction, the Russian reaction, to the surprise development of the fall of the pro-Russian government that I think caught NATO and the United States off guard. There had been a long-standing assumption that the territorial integrity of these new nations that had emerged from the fall of the Soviet Union would be intact and not be changed by armed aggression in any form. And as a result of Russian reaction, NATO has had to rethink that assumption and therefore its own plans, its own focus, its own resources, its own budgets, and to focus its attention once again on Eastern Europe as the, or Central Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. as the focus of deterrence and defense.
Well, the key there, which I was not aware of, maybe many of us were not, was the change in governments in Ukraine then. The former head of state was more pro-Russian.
Yes.
And what seemed to me to be connected, and of course that now has proved to be not the most important factor, is that Russia was striking or trying to destabilize at a time when this smaller nation was in its own turmoil and wasn't ready for such thing. But the real key is that the policy of Putin then was not being fulfilled as it would not be as fulfilled with the new government as it had been with the old.
No, the overthrow wasn't just a sort of a palace coup. There were a heavy orientation to the West involved, the emerging new government wanted to move Ukraine closer to the West in terms of its orientation and policies. In fact, the precipitating element, as I remember it, was some sort of association agreement with the EU, which many people in Ukraine wanted desperately to occur, and the former government was opposing. Mm-hmm. And that sort of led to the circumstances that ultimately toppled the former government. So it wasn't just a clash of personalities or political parties, mm-hmm. but I think as seen both from certainly from Russia's point of view, but also from the Western point of view, a clash of values and a clash of a vision of the future in which a substantial portion of Ukraine wanted to move in policy terms closer to Western Europe.
I'd like to jump to all those questions that come to me as a historian right now, but I think the thing that the listener wants to know is how critical is this moment for the safety of Europe?
Well, it is critical. A lot of very strong words have been used about how important it is. And at one level, it doesn't seem like the safety of Europe should be jeopardized, as difficult and disturbing and as menacing as these actions are in eastern Ukraine. But at another level, having shattered the assumption that the boundaries and territories of these nation states won't be changed by force, one wonders, is this the only example? Is this unique and a solitary case, or is it a precedent? And when you think about some of the explanations, or at least justifications, that have emerged from the Russian Federation itself in explaining its approach to Ukraine, Western Europe has become even more worried about it being a precedent. For example, the Russians have exerted what is an irredentist claim, a claim to be able, because it is Mother Russia, to be act on behalf of Russian populations anywhere. Even outside the borders of Russia. And so one starts to look, well, where are those Russian populations? Mm-hmm. And there are many scattered all over Eastern and Central Europe. And even more so, it's asserted the right to do so unilaterally at a time and place in a manner of its own choosing. Those are the kinds of thoughts and concepts that legitimately raise concern that this isn't an isolated or one-off incident, but might be a harbinger of more interventions to come. And if that's the case, it is deeply disturbing and very threatening to the peace of all of Europe. In addition to that, the Russians have described this territory that includes all of these new nations that emerged from the collapse of the Soviet Union as what they call post-Soviet space, in which the Russian Federation has a special interest. Those words are disturbing. Are disturbing as well. So yes, I think Western Europe, NATO, the United States have taken what's happening in the Ukraine seriously per se, because just in the Ukraine it's very serious, but also even more worrying about possible further similar developments.
Well, this gives me a nice transition into the next question I was going to have, and that is geography.
Right.
After which we'll do the history, and if we've got 20 minutes, we'll talk about even other subjects, what we're going to do with it. I want to, the critical role of Germany.
Yeah.
We should round this off. But as far as geography is concerned, unfortunately, this is not television. We don't have a map. But where would some of these major Russian populations be? I think of the Baltic states, for example, which border Russia. That'd be Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Not to mention Finland. Now, there's not big Russian populations there, but what about in the little Balkans, the little Baltic states?
Well, there are these very large pockets of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers who were, in a sense, metaphorically stranded by the ebb tide of Russian and Soviet power as the Soviet Union collapsed.
They were trucked in a sense, weren't they?
I mean, well, some of them
now
were,
they can't be trucked
some
up.
Of them were. One of the more worrying places is actually in Moldova,
oh, yes.
where the Transnistria district there, which has a large group of Russian populations, which have expressed in the past their interest in being associated directly with Russia. But that country is not in NATO. The Baltic states you mentioned, all three are in NATO, mm-hmm. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. So Russian populations, and acting, if the Russian Federation would act according to the words we just used in those areas, would be enormously threatening. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could threaten a general European war because of the collective defense responsibilities of NATO. Lithuania actually has a fairly small Russian population, but Latvia and Estonia have large ones. And Estonia in particular has a northeast tip to it that borders on Russia that is its population, the demographics here is about 95% Russians. And that's the group that you mentioned might have been trucked in. That area was essentially depopulated as populations fled in front of the fighting at the end of World War II in 1944. And following the defeat of Germany and the occupation of this area by the Red Army, the Soviet Union simply absorbed Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which had been independent countries, into the Soviet Union as Soviet republics. And Stalin literally trucked in tens of thousands of ethnic Russians to repopulate this northeast portion of Estonia and to work in the oil, shale, and chemical industries that were prominent in that area. And that population is one that has, since the re-independence of Estonia in the early 1990s, has been singled out by the Russian Federation as a population that's been mistreated by Estonia, treated unfairly, deprived of civic and political rights. And there's been just a litany of constant complaints from the Russian Federation about the conditions and deprivation of rights of this group of ethnic Russians living there. And that's led people to think that might be a vulnerable area. But remember, Estonia is in NATO, that's a different kettle of fish. I do want to say, I mean, all this is my personal opinion, of course, and but I do think if Estonia weren't in NATO, that Estonia would be very high up on the menu, that what's happening in the Ukraine would likely be happening in that northeast portion of Estonia.
When I did look at a map after I heard you describe the situation, I noticed that Estonia is what we might say in Purple Heart corner of Purple Heart Row. It's really it is the most eastern outpost of NATO.
And of the European Union. Estonia is a member of the European Union, too. Yeah. And, of course, really what, again, we go back to this clash of values and the sense of an old Europe and a new Europe. Estonia is a country that in one half of a generation literally transformed itself from being a part of the old Soviet Union into essentially being a modernizing Baltic or Western European nation and society. And so it's not just its location and its past, but what's been done and what it represents.
We're talking to Ambassador Lawrence Taylor, former ambassador to Estonia, so you can see why some of our talk has shifted from Ukraine to Estonia. Our announced topic was Ukraine, but all of them are involved. He has not only been an ambassador, but has been a founder of the Gettysburg Leadership Experience, to which he still lends a hand on occasion. You've already transposed us, Larry, from geography into history, this clash of values. As you take a long, long look at Mother Russia, some things really haven't changed much since the days of the Tsar, even though in the immediate past we shudder to think of those days of sword rattling and atomic winters when there was the Soviet Union. Right. In some ways, underneath, in my view, things have fundamentally not changed. Mother Russia has a tremendous pull on the people of Russia.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, Gary. Nationalism and pride in your ethnic heritage and history and your group membership is still one of the strongest forces in the world. And Russia is a great country, a great civilization, a great culture, and Russians are rightly proud of that heritage and of being Russian. And history, and even in the age of Facebook and Twitter and all the other digital magic that that we have, nations still define their national interests and national security more by geography than history than anything else. And so, as you look at that part of the world, and as you say, you remember the expansive and long historical role that Russia has played politically in dominating, ruling, governing, influencing this Central European space. You do realize they're going to see that area differently than we are, and they're going to attach probably a greater importance to political and security developments there than we do.
From geography and history to strategy and the politics of the day, where are we now? We took a blow, if not to our pride, to our sense of preparation when this happened in Ukraine. Did things go as
Putin wanted them too in Ukraine?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I doubt it. I think they went as he expected and wanted them to in Crimea, which is amazing, is predominantly Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the population there was probably welcoming to returning to Mother Russia. My guess would be that he expected the eastern portion of Ukraine to be maybe not as welcoming as Crimea had been, but not as difficult as it's turned out to be, where he's bogged down, the whole area is bogged down in what's called a frozen conflict that that seems to be going really nowhere, but either side, if either side tries to ratchet up more pressure, it only brings increasing pressure from the other side. So I think he probably expected to be welcomed there a bit more and to have the population a bit more in favor of the Russian rule there. But and having made the move, I think it would be very difficult for him to back down.
And he probably didn't expect the Ukrainian government, which was just barely in formation after this ouster of the former leader, to be quite so prepared to make a response. And they have had some difficulty mounting a military response.
Well, Ukraine is in a difficult position. It's kind of an economic basket and financial basket case, and it's been politically divided and disruptive. But given all of that, I think it's remarkable how the new president of Ukraine, how well he has mobilized a sense of identity, a sense of purpose, and with very limited resources, played his corner extremely well. So we'll have to see what happens. But at this point, I doubt that either President Putin or the Ukrainians can be happy about the situation in Eastern Ukraine.
If you and I, speaking of strategy, if you and I were sitting down now, which is very highly unlikely, and planning the next move for NATO or for the EU or for the United States relationship, who might we turn to? I think I know what the answer is going to be in the European Union, who would have the best opportunity for bridging the gap between the two, old and new Europe. But might it not be somewhere in Germany?
Well, I like your word of bridging, because at one level, NATO has refocused. It has, at a summit in September in Wales, taken new initiatives. It has new purpose. It has some new plans. It has bolstered the sense of collective defense, particularly in the Baltic states. President Obama went to Estonia itself to deliver U.S. assurances to NATO's collective defense. It was no accident, I would gather, that he went to Estonia to do that. So NATO itself is refocused and re-energized, and that's at one level absolutely necessary. But that's not a bridging mechanism. And you use the word bridge. So how do we go beyond that and try to reach a situation in which both NATO, the European Union, and Russia itself can be part of a solution rather than a standoff competitors in this situation? It's not easy to see how that's going to happen, obviously, but if it is going to happen, I think particularly the Chancellor of Germany, Mrs. Merkel, is the person who might be in the best position to at least attempt that bridging effort. And I stress the personality as different from the country. I'm not sure Germany itself has that potential. I think she may have that potential more as a representative of Europe collectively, frankly.
She's an East European, so she knows the old regime, the old Soviet regime.
She's the one Western leader who seems to have a solid and solidly communicative relationship with President Putin.
And she speaks Russian?
She speaks Russian. She grew up in East Germany. She viscerally knows that system and that part of Europe. But she's emerged as a magnificent leader of United Germany and of Europe. So, yes, I think if that bridging effort is to actually connect in a positive way, we would look to Mrs. Merkel to be probably the most important instrument of doing that.
We've been talking to Ambassador Lawrence Taylor about the situation in Ukraine and in Eastern Europe and its relationship to a Putin-led Russian Federation. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers. Thanks for joining us today, and have a very good day.
You've been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are those of the individual speakers and are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.